Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Peter Zoytlund, author of the new novel, Spin. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here, Jeff. Thank you.
Sure. Well, if someone hasn't yet heard about your new novel, Spin, how would you describe the novel?
Well, Spin is a work of historical fiction. It's my ninth book, but my first novel. I'd never written fiction before. And it is the story of an ancestor of mine who cycled around the world in the 1890s, a woman from Boston with three small children and a husband that she left behind. And it's a reimagination of her story. I had written a nonfiction book. My very first book was a nonfiction book based on her story. But this takes you sort of much deeper into her persona and into her mind, hopefully. It's written in the form of a long letter to her only grandchild, another distant relative of mine that I found during the course of my research of her story. But it's a story of a woman who stepped way, way outside the lines, so to speak, you know, the social conventions of her time, to take a remarkable around the world journey.
And so was this a family story that you heard? Obviously you, as you just explained, you novelized her experience, but yeah. As you also explained, you wrote a nonfiction book about her experience. Was, in terms of the nonfiction and the actual person, was this something that you had heard in your family, or how did you discover it?
Not at all. This was not a family story that was passed down through the generations. My mother and I first learned about this ancestor in a letter from a complete stranger back in 1993, who was an amateur cycling historian who had stumbled onto this story, and that there was nothing on the internet about it. It was completely lost to history. And in his letter, he said he was researching the story of the first woman to bike around the world, and he had done some genealogy research of his own, and it led him to believe that my mother might be a relative of this woman, Annie. My mother knew nothing about this woman, who was her grandfather's sister. She knew nothing about the bicycle trip, and it wasn't until 10 years later, 2003, when I received a letter from the same fellow. You know, we told him we couldn't help him, but 10 years later, he wondered if we had learned anything in the interim. And I had, you know, over the years, asked other distant relatives that we would see at family events if anyone had heard of her, and always came up with a complete blank. So in 2003, when he wrote to me again, I thought, you know, this story is so incredible. This woman in the 1890s rides a bicycle around the world, leaving a husband and three small children behind. Well, why does nobody in my family know this story? And that's when I decided to pursue it on my own, you know, not knowing how far I would get, given there was a complete paucity of information out there about her.
And what did you do to research the history of her trip around the world?
Well, you know, that initial letter that we received in 1993, the writer enclosed two newspaper articles, contemporaneous, articles about her trip. One from a newspaper in Boston and another from Omaha almost a year later. And the trip began in Boston. My great-grand aunt Annie lived in the old West End of Boston. And there was a clue in one of those letters articles that he had enclosed, which said that the trip actually began at the steps of the Massachusetts State Capitol. So my first call was to the State House Library of Massachusetts, thinking, well, maybe they've got some record of this event, a photograph, something. And when I called, the librarian who answered the phone, a woman named Ava Murphy, what struck me was that she didn't even hesitate for 2 seconds before telling me she knew that they didn't have anything about her. And I said, well, and she explained that a few weeks earlier, She'd had an inquiry by email about my great-grandaunt from someone in Texas. And I thought, well, this is really strange. And this is not the guy who wrote us the letter, the original letter. This was somebody else. And I thought, well, that's really strange. I wonder if I have a long-lost relative in Texas who's pursuing this story. And long story short, she connected the two of us. A guy named Dennis McCown, who was a professor down in Austin area. And it turns out we are not related at all. But he stumbled onto Annie's story in a most remarkable way himself. If we have time, I could tell you that story. But
sure.
It's what got me going. So I know this will seem quite tangential, but I promise you it'll be worth it. Dennis explained to me that he stumbled onto Annie's story while researching a story of an ancestor of his own, a woman from El Paso named Helen Beulah Morose. Helen had been married to a ne'er-do-well named Martin, a cattle rustler. And Martin had been arrested in El Paso on a cattle rustling charge in 1895. And she and Helen and Martin escaped across the Rio Grande into Juarez, Mexico. But she decided to come back into El Paso to hire a lawyer to represent him. And she hired a man by the name of John Wesley Hardin. And people may know that name because John Wesley Hardin was the most notorious gunslinger of the Old West, had killed by his own count, by some counts, 24 men, maybe as many as 48 men by the time he was in his early 20s. And now, having served half his life in prison and been released, he was now, believe it or not, practicing law in El Paso. And Helen hired him, and they quickly became embroiled in a very intense affair. And one night in July of 1895, four law enforcement officers paid by Hardin lured Martin across the river back into El Paso, where they murdered him. And Dennis was researching this story. And what he stumbled across in the newspaper accounts, he was wondering, well, where was John Wesley Hardin on the night of the murder? Because he paid for it, but he didn't commit it. And it turned out he was sitting with Helen in a theater, listening to a lecture by a young woman from Boston, going around the world on a bicycle. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. My Jewish great-grandaunt from Boston crossed paths with John Wesley Hardin in El Paso, Texas in 1895. And I said, I have got to get to the bottom of this story. It's just so incredible. And try and figure out why no one in my family ever heard of it. So that's what got me started in earnest. And it was took me 4 years of pretty steady work to painstakingly start to piece her story together, mainly relying on old newspaper accounts, because it turns out she was a very gifted self-promoter with a very modern sense of celebrity and left, as it turns out, a trail of newspaper coverage all over the world about her trip. And it was while keep in mind, back in the early 2000s, very few newspapers were digitized and searchable. So it was a very painstaking process, microfilm, staring at microfilm reels hour after hour after hour. And I simultaneously hired a genealogist to help me determine if Annie had any direct living descendants, distant relatives of mine, who might be able to shed light on the mystery. And I got a little bit of encouragement when I came across an article in the New York World newspaper, one of the only articles out of more than 1,000 I've collected, that mentioned that Annie had 3 young children that she'd left behind, something she preferred not to discuss. But as appalling as that seemed at first, it also gave me hope, because I realized that if those children had children, they could well be alive. This was, back in the early 2000s. And that led me to Annie's only direct living descendant, a granddaughter named Mary, who's my second cousin once removed. And I ended up connecting with Mary, and she knew her grandmother. She was 16 when her grandmother died in the 1940s. And so I had her memories. And as it turns out, buried in Mary's basement, some scrapbooks and souvenirs and artifacts of this bicycle trip that had been gathering dust for, 100 years.
Wow. So you wrote this nonfiction book, as you just explained, and in the interim, you said that was your first nonfiction book,
yeah.
And in the interim, you've written other nonfiction books.
That's right.
What prompted you to come back to this topic, to novelize it for your debut novel, Spin?
This is a great, I love telling this story. In November of 2019, the New York Times ran an obituary, a belated obituary about Annie. They were doing, if you read the Times, you may know that they've been doing a series for a couple of years called Overlooked No More.
Sure.
Obituaries of primarily women and people of color who, looking back, would have merited an obit in the Times, but which, the obit pages have been dominated by white men. And so an obit, a half a page obit appeared in the Times that I didn't know was coming, and it relied a lot on my first book. And my wife, Judy, who is very involved in the book club world nationally, she's got a newsletter with over 10,000 avid book club members, and she knows what they like to read. And she said to me when the obit came out, said, "You have got to write this as historical fiction, because if you don't, somebody's going to, and you've already done the research." Some people will work on historical fiction for a decade, doing the research. She said, "You've already done the research." So I've never written fiction in my life, and I figured I had to humor her, and I would write 20 or 25 pages. It would be disastrous. I'd show it to my agents, who would tell me it was disastrous, and that would be the end of it. But she liked the first 25 pages and encouraged me to keep going. And the result was this novel, Spin, which I should mention as a subtitle of a novel based on a parenthetical, mostly true story. And that's relevant here because Annie herself was writing historical fiction in real time as she traveled. And what I mean by that is that she was all about making a sensation of herself. She knew what appealed to the sensationalist instincts of the newspapers of the day. And so she spun a lot of tall tales about herself and about where she had been and about, things that had happened in her travels as she went around the world. And the first book, was really a task of teasing out fact from fiction, what really happened and what did Annie make up? And I didn't know that starting out. I was well into my research when it started to dawn on me that there was more than met the eye in Annie's story. And although I was at first disappointed because I thought I'm not going to be able to establish her claim to be the first woman around the world on a bicycle, but I slowly realized that I actually had a more interesting character on my hands, not just a woman with, mental fortitude and physical endurance. So it was really that obit in the New York Times in the fall of 2019 that spurred the novel's Spin.
And so what was the experience like for you writing your first novel?
It took me a little while to get over thinking I can't do this because I've never done it before. Once I sat down to do it, I actually found it to be a lot of fun. Since most of my other writing has been journalistic and very much sort of, a lot of fealty to the facts of any given story, it was kind of liberating to be able to take liberties with Annie's story, but in a way that I thought, still was authentic, in the sense that I think the book is very true to her character. And the arc of the story is true. And what book groups seem to have enjoy about Spin is trying to tease out, what's true in this book? What did the author make up? And what did the protagonist make up? it was just fun to create dialogue, to create encounters, to sort of fill in, to imagine you know, a world in which I could fill in the blanks in her story. Because the real historical record is somewhat sparse in certain ways. I mean, there's a rich trove of newspaper articles, excuse me, but very little else. I was thrilled to meet my cousin Mary, but disappointed that no, she didn't have a diary of this trip. But Annie did leave one first-person account of this trip behind, a big feature that she wrote for the front page of the special Sunday section of the New York World, which was one of the most prominent newspapers of the day. But even that story, it was quite clear to me when I found it, you know, was riddled with her tall tales and her, you know, exaggerations. So it wasn't exactly a historical record, but it was really quite liberating, I think, in a way, to write fiction and, you know, create this world. And it brought her to life in a way that I don't think the nonfiction account could do. And, you know, I decided to write it in the form of a long letter written to Mary late in Annie's life. You know, she's writing to her granddaughter, telling her things about her life, about her relationships. And I didn't give a lot of thought to why I did it that way. It just seemed, it was sort of more of a gut instinct. But in retrospect, it dawned on me that the reason I wrote it that way is that since I first, quote unquote, virtually met Annie in 1993, she kind of lived in my head now for decades. And I just always wished I could sit down with her over a cup of coffee and have her tell me her story just for an hour or 2 hours. And I think this was my way of letting her tell me her story, although in the book, she's telling it to her granddaughter, Mary.
Sure. So what was your initial writing journey that led you to writing the nonfiction books that you've written? Did you study journalism?
No, no background in journalism, really. After graduating from Amherst College near you, I went to law school, just like a lot of writers. Practiced law, taught law for a few years. It wasn't really for me. And then I went to work in 1985 for a nonprofit called the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. It was my good fortune. We talk about timing is everything. I started working there in the late spring of 1985. And in October of that year, the organization was selected as the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize for that year. And I was hired to be the director of public affairs, which was, you know, kind of communications and press relations, really with no experience. But boy, you know, quickly accelerated because the profile of the organization, you know, went international, all this attention from the Nobel Prize. And while I was in that job, I started writing a lot of op-ed opinion pieces that started to get picked up by a lot of the big national newspapers, and even some had some published abroad in, like, you know, in Soviet Union and Pakistan and India. And I actually got quite a kick out of it. I'd never had a byline before. I don't want to say it was an ego trip, but it was a little bit of an ego boost. And I thought, well, maybe I have a little bit of a knack for this, you know. These pieces are getting picked up with some regularity. So that's really kind of when I started writing professionally, so to speak. And then it evolved. I kind of always had an ambition to write a book, but I didn't know about what. And then this story kind of, in 1993, fell into my lap in the form of this letter I mentioned. And that's where it started.
So I'm curious, do you have plans to write any other novels, or are you working on another nonfiction book now?
Right now, I don't, but I have one idea that I've had, and this is sort of also related to my great-grandaunt Annie. When she published that first-person account in the New York World that I mentioned, it wasn't byline Annie Londonderry, which was her assumed name, by the way. It was, her real name was Annie Cohen Kopchowski, Kopchowski being her married name. The byline was Nellie Bly Jr. Nellie Bly was the most famous journalist of her day. She had made an around-the-world trip as a publicity stunt for the Pulitzer Papers several years before Annie made her bike trip. And I think it was direct inspiration for Annie. And Nellie Bly's, you know, what she was endeavoring to do was to beat the fictional record established by Jules Verne's character, Phileas Fogg, in Around the World in 80 Days. And then when after the bike trip, Annie briefly became Nellie Bly's replacement, so to speak, at the New York World. Nellie Bly had a falling out with her editors, and they were always looking for what they called women stunt journalists. These were women who were doing sort of investigative pieces, often very quite sensational. And so Annie, in addition to her account of the bike trip, started writing a series of sensational features for the New York World. And I thought that that chapter in her life, which was brief but colorful, might make the subject a good subject for another novel. We'll see. I'm not committed to it. Not completely sure. Committed to it yet, but I'm tossing the idea around.
Well, what novels or nonfiction books have you read recently that you enjoyed?
Recently? Oh, my. Well, that's hard. I can tell you my three favorite novels of all time. I would put number one as William Styron's The Confessions of Nat Turner. And two of them were John Steinbeck books, East of Eden and The Grapes of Wrath. In fact, it was Steinbeck, one of Steinbeck's books, Travels with Charlie, that inspired the book I wrote before Spin, which was called The Dog Went Over the Mountain, in which I took our aging rescue dog, Albie, who left us last New Year's Eve, on a cross-country car trip, more or less along the route that Steinbeck had followed, you know, some 60 years before, or 50 years before, or almost 60 years. So those would be my top three. I've also written a lot about animal rescue, particularly dogs. So I've tended to read a lot of books, on that subject.
Sure.
There's one that's fairly obscure, but which I thought was sent to me by the author. It's called Catching Dawn. And she sent it to me looking for, a blurb for the cover. I didn't know her. It was a small publisher I'd never heard of. And I get asked this a lot, and I'm always wary because I obviously don't want to commit to something if I haven't read the book. And it absolutely blew me away. It's called Catching Dawn. It was a beautiful memoir about rescuing dogs, but about finding family and finding a way home. It was really quite beautiful.
That's great. Well, I'm curious, were you able to confirm if Annie genuinely circled the globe on a bike?
Well, here's the thing. You know, she ostensibly made this trip to settle a wager. That was the story that was reported all over the world, and that wager had certain conditions. Now, whether the wager actually existed or she concocted it is something we could debate. But one of the conditions was that she ride 10,000 miles by bicycle on this round-the-world trip. Now, ironically, when she wrote her first-person account for the New York World, she claimed to have logged exactly 9,604, which is an awfully precise number, and less than the amount to which she was publicly committed. She absolutely made a trip around the world. In my estimation, she rode, probably anywhere between 5,000 and 7,000 miles on a bicycle, mm-hmm. but she covered a lot of ground and water, by ship. I mean, obviously no one can literally ride around the world on a bicycle, but she took considerable liberties with her means of travel, particularly in certain parts of the world. I would say that I think she has a real purchase on the claim to have been the first woman to ride across the American continent, although not in one contiguous stretch, because she first traveled from New York to Chicago, reversed course, went around the world traveling eastward, arrived in San Francisco, and then rode back to Chicago. There were some stints by train there, but most of her riding was in the United States and in France. So, we'll never know.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, we'll probably never know exactly what happened.
Well, where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your new novel, Spin?
Yeah, so there are two websites. I have one that I created well before I wrote Spin. It's devoted to Annie Londonderry, and that's www.annielondonderry.com. I should mention briefly, if I can, Jeff, that the name Londonderry was adopted by Annie because the Londonderry Lithia Spring Water Company of Nashua, Hampshire, was her first corporate sponsor. She actually had corporate sponsors. She pioneered sports-related marketing for women, among other things, and carried advertising banners wherever she went. It's part of the way she earned her way around the world. So there's a lot of information about that at AnnieLondonderry.com, and a lot about how this trip figured into the women's movement, the suffrage movement. There's a whole social historical context for this trip that's important. And then I have an author website, which is www.peterzeutlin.com. My last name is spelled Z-H-E-U-T-L-I-N. So you can find out about my other books there and a lot more about Annie Londonderry on the other side.
That's great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Peter Zeutlin, author of the novel Spin. The novel is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Peter, thanks for doing this interview.
Jeff, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.